Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kavika Martin of Peace Action, who assesses the recent U.S. Senate vote, passing a motion to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Ravi Raghbir, executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition, who explains how his group provides support for immigrants targeted by the Trump administration's punitive immigration policies. And Alex Cornell DeHoo and Megan Sally Wells of Elected Officials to Protect America, who talk about their group's letter from over 300 U.S. elected officials released at the recent U.N. Climate Summit calling for a nationwide plan to phase out fossil fuels. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As the Taliban continued to combat 14,000 U.S. ground troops in Afghanistan, former U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad is leading U.S. efforts for peace talks to end the 17-year-long Afghan war. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has dramatically stepped up airstrikes, dropping more than 5,200 bombs and munitions in the first 9 months of 2018. According to the Los Angeles Times, Trump's setting an April target date for peace talks is similar to the approach followed by President Obama, when he set a 2014 deadline for ending U.S. involvement in most combat operations and withdrew all but 5,500 troops, a strategy which was sharply criticized by Donald Trump. U.S. military commanders believe the Afghan government would quickly fall without the presence of U.S. troops. Khalilzad is urging the Taliban rebels and Afghan President Ashraf Ghani to prepare a blueprint for negotiations before Afghanistan's presidential election in April. However, prospects for peace remain low. Chicago charter school teachers went on strike December 4th, in the first charter school strike in the U.S. The four-day labor action targeted the politically connected Acero Charter Network. 500 striking teachers won a tentative deal for better pay, smaller class size, and sanctuary protections for immigrant students. Members will be voting to approve the four-year contract in the coming weeks. The strike by the Chicago Teachers Union put pressure on Chicago's political establishment and high-level charter school supporters. Before the strike, the CTU claimed Acero, which emerged out of the scandal-plagued United Neighborhood Organization, was sitting on millions of dollars in funds rather than offering pay raises. With the retirement of Mayor Rahm Emanuel, the CTU strike signals a tougher environment for Chicago charter schools. The Chicago Board of Education recently voted to close two charter schools and rejected applications for two others. Chris Berend, the CTU Charter Division Chair, said, "Our employers have business interests, and sometimes those are in conflict with our students' interests." He pledged to push back and change the charter school industry so they will stop exploiting students. The incoming House Democratic majority plans to push for strong gun control regulations in the new year. Universal background checks are a top agenda item for Democratic leaders and gun safety groups. Currently, private sales of guns and sales at gun shows are exempt from federal gun background checks. Mother Jones Magazine reports that 22% of nationwide gun sales take place without any background check. The National Rifle Association and their Republican allies have successfully blocked gun reforms like universal background checks since the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre on December 14, 2012. A bipartisan bill mandating background checks was blocked by GOP House Speaker Paul Ryan, despite having 208 co-sponsors that included 14 Republicans. California House Democrat Mike Thompson intends to introduce a bill requiring background checks on every gun sale or transfer, regulations that go further than previous legislation. The move has been in the works since before the election, when Thompson met with gun reform groups including the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, Every Town for Gun Safety, the Center for American Progress, and the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Gun safety advocates say a recent poll found that 97% of Americans surveyed support expanded background checks since the mass school shooting at Parkland, Florida's Stoneman Douglas High School. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In a dramatic departure from decades of congressional deference to the executive branch on foreign policy issues, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution calling for an end to U.S. military support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. The resolution, passed by a vote of 56 to 41 on December 13th, received support from all Senate Democrats, 7 Republicans, and 2 Independents. If signed into law, the resolution would require the U.S. to stop providing intelligence, targeting assistance, and other military logistical support to the Saudi government and its allies in the Yemen conflict. The measure, which failed to win enough Senate votes in March, was brought back for a vote after the brutal murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi that U.S. intelligence agencies believe was ordered by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. While the vote was the first time the Senate invoked the 1973 War Powers Act to rein in a president's war-making power, it won't have the force of law because the House blocked a vote on the resolution, and President Trump would most certainly veto the legislation if it ever reached his desk. In the war between the Saudi-U.S.-backed Yemeni government and Houthi rebels, an estimated 85,000 children have died of hunger since the bombing began in 2015. The United Nations considers the situation in Yemen to be the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today, with some 14 million people facing starvation. Recent talks between the warring parties in Sweden succeeded in brokering a ceasefire in the main port city of Hodeida, the entry point for critically needed food and humanitarian aid. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, Peace Action Senior Director for Policy and Political Affairs, who assesses the significance of the recent U.S. Senate vote on Yemen and prospects for ongoing peace negotiations to end the conflict.
So it is significant that the U.S. Senate, Congress is saying to the administration that there needs to be a change in this policy, and we need to be putting pressure on our allies, Saudi Arabia, and other parts of the party to come to the table and figure out a political solution to stop the humanitarian disaster. So it is very significant. At the same time that this was being voted on, the UN was leading discussions with some of the internal parties involved, the Yemen government and the Houthi rebels, which are the main parties that are clashing within Yemen. And they ended up actually reaching some agreements, which is significant. Definitely a big political win and significant to putting pressure on these parties to come to a resolution. And it's a good constitutional win. Peace Action worked on passing the War Powers Resolution. That, as people remembered, came up after the Vietnam War, where that was never declared war, and Congress wanted to make sure that had some sort of influence on what the Constitution says is the right of Congress to declare war. So the War Powers Act was passed, and it was actually passed over the veto of Nixon at the time. And it has been invoked many times. This is the first time, actually, that it went all the way through to have a vote on the Senate side. And so that is significant to see that happen. And to see that the political pressure that it has been putting on the parties. Unfortunately, it's not going to get a vote on the House side. The House GOP Republican leadership have constantly been using arcane parliamentary moves to block any votes in the House. So we won't see a vote in the House, at least this session, but we expect next year to see something different.
So in January, when the Democrats take control of the House of Representatives, if there is a vote on the War Powers Resolution to end U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen, does there have to be a second vote in the Senate? And what are the prospects that this will come to anything, given that President Trump would have to sign such a bill to go into the force of law?
Yeah, it's difficult to see how the War Powers Resolution will actually become law, because as you mentioned, we do need to get enough votes to override Trump's veto, or, you know, would Trump veto? That's an assumption, but I would assume, yes, it would be his first veto. So it's like, it would be a big news item. I think you're right. It's going to be a difficult vote to get. But as we've seen, these votes and the attention have their own political power, even if they don't become law. So we definitely are putting pressure on Democratic leadership to bring this vote up as soon as possible in the new Congress. We're pretty sure we have now the votes in the House of Representatives next year. Now, the Senate will probably lose a few votes in what we just had, but still should have enough to pass. And then let's have the president veto it if that's what he wants to do. The news stories that will come out of that will also continue to put pressure on the administration and the warring parties to make a solution. And then Congress can take up some of its other powers over the year by perhaps putting language in appropriations bills, restrictive language, restricting funding. There's other things that can happen, you know, over that process, but that process only will take into effect, you know, the following year. And here we have a situation in which a child is dying, you know, almost every 10 minutes in Yemen. So we need quicker action. So we're certainly hoping to see these votes happen early next year. The UN process, we see the meetings that happened last week are supposed to continue in early January. So continued political pressure is needed on the parties to come up with a political solution.
Paul, can you provide our listeners with an update on what's going on with the peace negotiations that the United Nations brokered in Sweden? As I understand it, they succeeded in having a ceasefire agreement for the vital port of Hodeida, where all the food and emergency medical supplies would have to go through in order to help all those victims of the war, people who are suffering from famine and the cholera epidemic.
The ceasefire was agreed to not only in the port of Hodeida, but a couple of other ports. But as you mentioned, Hodeida is the pipeline of anywhere between 70 to 90% of the needs of the country. So it's very important to have a ceasefire there to allow that port to have the influx of the medical and humanitarian aid that's needed to come through that to help all the Yemenis that are in dire need of medicines and foods. The UN still needs to put together some monitoring to keep the ceasefire going. So I do think it's a positive sign. Talks are always better than no talks. Ceasefires, even if they get broken, are better than no ceasefires. You know, this is where you have to put your hope hat on and hope that these things hold and these negotiations continue.
That was Paul Kavika Martin, Peace Action's Senior Director for Policy and Political Affairs. Learn more about efforts to end U.S. involvement in the Yemen war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Trump administration's anti-immigrant attacks have taken two forms: detaining and then deporting thousands of newcomers at the border who are fleeing violence and poverty, mostly from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and arresting people who've been in the country for decades, often have U.S. citizen children, and are fully integrated into their communities. On December 15th, the local chapter of Democratic Socialists of America hosted a fundraiser in New Haven to benefit the Connecticut Immigrant Bail Fund. The three immigrants who spoke at the event ran the gamut from a new arrival to a long-term resident. All of them had been incarcerated by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and had been released from detention with assistance from the Immigrant Bail Fund. The keynote speaker at the event was Ravi Ragbir, executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition, originally a New York City-based organization that has since expanded into New Jersey and Connecticut. The group also now has a presence on the U.S.-Mexico border. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ragbir, who describes how his organization trains volunteers to keep the focus on the immigrants' needs. But he starts by telling his own story of almost being deported back to Trinidad after living in the U.S. for 24 years.
I went in for a regular check-in with my community of supporters and friends, my wife, my attorneys. I decided that they were not going to give me a stay, even though they kept saying that they were looking at it. In fact, instead, they handcuffed me and took me away. They took me away on January 11th, and they flew me down to Florida. And on January 12th, even though there was a court order not to remove me, they were still planning to put me in a plane to Trinidad. Fortunately, they didn't do that. Instead, they kept me in Florida until the court insisted I come back to New York, where they held me at Orange County Detention Center. And then on January 29th, the district court, the Southern District Court, insisted that I be released from their custody.
And are you still fighting deportation, though, or not?
Yes, I am. I haven't won my case. In fact, there's 8 court cases right now based upon me in New Jersey and New York. And until 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, when after we had the First Amendment hearing, we were very worried because there was only one stay in place, which is the Second District of New York. We had a hearing, and 3 days later, they issued an order, not a decision, to ICE saying to keep their hands off me until they make a decision. So there was a First Amendment argument and hearing, and they are saying, well, until we make that decision, I have to be kept in the United States. And since then, a lot of that weight has lifted off my shoulders. And I was in San Diego and Tucson recently. And, you know, what was interesting, when I went to San Diego, like 2 weeks ago, 2 Mondays ago, I hadn't traveled before since January 11th. And throughout the process on January 11th, when they were moving me around, I didn't know it was bothering me until, you know, 2 weeks ago when I was getting on the plane. And as I stepping into the plane, there was all this anxiety that has started to get agitated, and I didn't realize I was still suffering from that traumatic situation. So when people think they are not suffering, people who are living through this process, they are, but they're coping with it on a very different level.
When you train people to accompany people, that you call it advocacy without confrontation, can you explain what that means?
Sure. We have 3 rules. One is no judgment. The other is respect. And last, do no harm. So what we have always told the citizens who are privileged to be aware of the impact of your actions has on other people, which means that if a citizen has to get upset because of the injustice they're seeing, the impact will be on the person who they're accompanying, detrimental to their well-being. So we have had to teach them how to advocate without being confrontational. And that's why we say advocacy without confrontation. In fact, one of the ways you know you're doing the accompaniment program wrong is if you're speaking. So we teach people how to keep quiet, how to shut up, but still have their presence felt and presence known. And that has made a difference in Federal Plaza because, you know, no one there is confrontational. But they are confrontational. You know what I'm saying is, like, how could ICE react when they know someone is being nice to them? How can you remove people when someone is being nice to you?
So, and you're saying where was this, or this is in all your work? Was there a geographic reference that I missed?
So our work revolves around New York right now, but we have done training like in Connecticut and Massachusetts, New Hampshire, California, Phoenix. So we have done these trainings everywhere because it does make an impact, and it is very, very, as you heard it for the other speakers, it's very critical for them to know that someone is standing with them through this process.
And just the last thing, do you have any presence at the border? I mean, your organization, or not now?
We have a presence right now on the border, a small team doing the trainings, and we expect to have a larger presence as we get later on in the weeks as things solidify. Our goal is to have enough people, a few hundred people, who will be helping those who want to seek refuge in the U.S. With their paperwork, and ultimately there will be 10,000 people who we will have helped throughout this process to seek refuge. And it is not just about the border, because when they come across, they will want to go, they will need to go to their destination. So if it's in Connecticut, we find a way to get them to Connecticut and to continue to support them through the process.
That was Ravi Raghbir, executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition. Learn more about the group and immigrant support by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 2018 COP24 Climate Summit in Katowice, Poland, concluded on December 15th with 196 nations reaching agreement to implement the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, including methods of measuring and reporting on reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. However, the poorest and most vulnerable countries felt that it demanded too little of industrialized nations. As expected, the Trump administration confirmed its alliance with the fossil fuel industry and hostility toward coordinated action to address climate change. Scientists and negotiators acknowledge that the Paris rulebook agreed upon won't be enough to stop carbon pollution from reaching critical levels. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a dire warning in October that the world has only a 10 to 12-year window to limit an increase in global temperatures below 1.5 degrees centigrade to avert disastrous drought, wildfires, crop failures, flooding, extreme weather events, and coral reef destruction. Delegates at the Katowice Climate Summit were met with repeated protests from environmentalists and young people who maintain the world's governments aren't doing enough to avert climate catastrophe. Your reporter spoke with Alex Cornell DeHoo and Megan Sally Wells of the group Elected Officials to Protect America, who talk about their group's letter released at the climate summit, signed by over 300 U.S. elected officials from 40 states, calling for a nationwide plan to phase out fossil fuels and adopt a Green New Deal strategy to increase production of renewable energy and move to a 100% fossil-free society.
While we were disappointed that the U.S. did not provide the leadership that is really necessary to take the issue of climate change on, we still had 50% of the U.S. population and cities representing over 50% of the U.S. economy, really showing that the states and the local governments are leading the way. So while at the federal level, the talks were disappointing and their focus on coal and energy is really the wrong way to go and detrimental to our health and our security, the state and local governments have made a very strong statement saying that we are committed to protecting our planet and ensuring the health and safety of our citizens. As you're probably aware, is that if we stay on the track we're continuing, the global temperature will rise at 3 degrees. And the IPCC report, the report that really is one of the hallmark climate reports, has shown that if we do not do something to keep it at 1.5, we will not prevent the catastrophic storms, the droughts, and the fires that we are already seeing. And the reality is the effects of climate change are happening now. And it's a matter of how we can mitigate those effects. I mean, when I was deployed to the Marine Corps in the Middle East, I saw the effects every day because the population, unfortunately, there doesn't have the barriers and the protections that we have in America. Someone tried to blow my vehicle up, and he wasn't very good at it, fortunately, and we caught him and realized he was a farmer who had been paid a couple $100s because of the massive drought and record-setting drought that had happened, and he was vulnerable to Al-Qaeda recruiting him. He's still accountable for his actions, but he was put in a situation because of the U.S., China, and other major countries that are polluting changed the climate that he was living in.
More than 300 mayors, state representatives, and elected officials from 40 states across the U.S. signed a letter calling for a nationwide plan to phase out the production and use of fossil fuels, just reading from your press release here, and a real priority to develop renewable energy sources as part of a Green New Deal approach to energy and efficiency. Tell us about these local and state elected officials and what they've put their signature on. Megan, did you want to address that?
We've got three main points that we're asking for, that we produce 100% clean, renewable energy, starting with significant investments in disadvantaged communities and places that are most affected by pollution and that are currently dependent on fossil fuel jobs. The second point is that we want to end permitting of new oil, gas, and coal projects and infrastructure and begin a swift managed decline of fossil fuel production, starting with phasing out production within a 250-foot public health buffer zone of occupied buildings and vulnerable areas where the greatest harms occur. And I'll just add, if you've ever been to Los Angeles, it's a megalopolis that's built on oil. And so you've got oil in the unlikeliest places, right next to homes and apartments, schools, churches. We even have oil drilling in one of our malls. It's behind a wall. You can't see it, but it's actually happening right next to where people are shopping and recreating. And it's a huge issue in Culver City as well. And then the third ask is we need to end the subsidizing of fossil fuels. We need to divest from fossil fuel companies and shift our public investments to accelerate the transition to 100% clean energy and help pay for the harm that fossil fuels have caused in our states and our municipalities. So we've got a lot of work to do, and it's great that so many leaders all over the country have signed on to this vision. We've just begun, and I think we'll be getting more signatures as we move forward.
That was Alex Cornell DeHoo, president of the group Elected Officials to Protect America, and Megan Sally Wells, vice mayor of Culver City, California, who serves on the group's National Steering Committee. Learn more about Elected Officials to Protect America by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WLSL in St. Leo, Florida, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KSER in Everett, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.